I was born in Trochu, Alberta, on the 22nd of May 1910. My parents were immigrants from France, and the village of Trochu had been founded by a group of Frenchmen who had come the end of the last century and the early days of this century. My father was a former French army officer, and in 1914 he returned to France and rejoined his unit in the French army and fought in the First World War. Shortly after he returned, we moved to Edmonton, where I went to school, and eventually, on my father's death in 1923, my mother and my sister and I went to live with my grandparents, who had a farm southeast of Stettler. From there, I went on to high school and eventually university at studying civil engineering. During the summers, I worked for the Canadian National Railway on construction projects. Following my graduation in 1933, I worked at a variety of jobs, including one hydrographic survey of the Mackenzie River Delta. Thereafter, I was a foreman and then an engineer in the single unemployment relief camps that had been set up by the federal government to handle the frightful problem of unemployment which existed at that time, somewhat similar to what we have had recently.
What was it like working there with you being employed and everyone else being unemployed?
Well, I was unemployed too.
But you were being paid?
Yes, well, yes, but they were paid too. I was paid a little more than they were, but I got the same clothing and the same free tobacco, the same food. The circumstance there was rather interesting. There were probably a higher percentage of unemployed engineers than any other profession, and the man who was then the chairman of the Engineering Institute branch in Edmonton, Professor Hardy of the University of Alberta, campaigned with the federal government to employ unemployed engineers as gang bosses and foremen and various other supervisory positions in these camps. And that is how myself and a large number of other engineers were taken on the camps. I started as a straw boss with a gang of men with picks and shovels and wheelbarrows building a landing strip near Edmonton. Later we worked on highways, and eventually I became engineer in charge of a group of several camps in the Kananaskis River Valley west of Calgary. The objective here was to develop an area which would become a federal forestry experimental station, and it still is today. And that was a pleasant job, and I think the men too were interested because they could see they were doing something useful in beautiful surrounding. It's one of the loveliest valleys in the Rockies, and so it was a very satisfying job, although the future seemed pretty grim in those days. At that time, we were located quite near some of the hydro plants that belonged to Calgary Power Company, now TransAlta Utilities. And I met some of the people. And so when the camps were closed down on the change in government, I succeeded in getting a job with Calgary Power, what they called their apprentice engineer program, which also was a far-sighted undertaking of the company to employ engineers and teach them the power utility business from the ground up. And we were paid a very small salary, but we learned a great deal. In fact, the man who has just retired as chairman of the board of TransAlta Utilities, which is now an extremely large company, was one of the apprentice engineers who was taken on that program. Well, that was the time when trouble was starting to brew in Europe, and within 3 years the war started, and I joined the militia in Calgary, as I mentioned to you the other day.
You thought war was likely?
Oh yes. It from 1938 on, when the Germans overran Czechoslovakia, there was no doubt in anyone's mind, anyone who bothered to read the papers, that the war was inevitable, because the feeling was that the British and the French had ceded so much that there was no going back, that Hitler had the upper hand, and everything he did was a success in the advance of the Nazis, and everything we did was futile. That was the feeling that one had. And of course, the countries, the Britain, France, Canada, and to some extent the United States began rearming, but it was very inadequate, and it was too late. So that when the Germans burst out, there was no holding them, and the war effort then multiplied tenfold. But it was well, you know the rest of the story. It was years before we were able to mount an offensive, which was only made possible through the United States joining the Allies.
Which militia did you join?
This was the Signal Corps in Calgary. It was, the unit was called the 13th District Signals, which was a training unit for the militia. The senior officers and NCOs in the unit were mainly World War I veterans who had remained in Signals between the two wars, and they had kept up to advancing technology. But unfortunately, because of lack of funds, they were not able to obtain modern equipment. And so the training was done with World War I equipment.
Such as, what were some of the things you used?
Well, telephones and Aldous lamps to a small extent, and very primitive radio sets were more trouble than they were good. You never knew whether they were going to function or not. And there were the quality, when they were functioning, the quality of the reception was so poor that half the time you couldn't understand what was going on. However, it was possible to use key code, Morse code, even with the poor quality. But radio telephone, which became the standard form of communications during the war for fast action, was almost impossible. So it was frustrating, but nevertheless we learned the basics, and learned something about Army discipline and the organization of Army, how it functions.
How often would the militia meet?
It was once a week.
And then
there were two-week summer camps. And the people who were in the militia were very dedicated. They would, without hesitation, give up their summer holidays. In those days, a standard summer holiday, if you got it, was 2 weeks. And they would give up their holidays to go on the camp. In those days, we still had some horses. The summer camps were held at the Sarcy military camp, just outside of Calgary. Well, it's within the city limits now, I think. But I think there's still an army camp there. So there are many thousands of people who spent their two-week summer vacation training there.
And what sort of exercises would you do?
Well, it was small-scale war games. We would divide up the camps into two armies, and as far as possible with the men and equipment available, set up the equivalent of a formation, a division or a brigade. And each of the arms and services would try to carry out wartime functions. It was fun. It was a lot of fun. Young kids loved it. They were tearing around through the bushes.
What was your rank?
I was a second lieutenant.
And do you remember how much you were paid?
I think it was probably $3 a day. I'm not sure, but I think probably that's what it was. So there was no question of making money. Well, eventually, war was declared in the late summer of 1939, and many of the people that I knew joined the active force immediately, and as far as signals was concerned, they were posted to the 1st Division signals, because the 1st Division was the only division that was mobilized initially. And later in the fall, the 2nd Division was mobilized, but I held back. There was a feeling at that time, it was the period of the phony war, there was a feeling that the whole thing might be over in 6 months or so. And I held back because for that reason. But then, as time went on, it looked as though it wasn't going to be a phony war, and arrangements were made to mobilize the 3rd Division. And when that was announced, I decided that I would join up. Well, then, matters were hastened by the invasion of Norway and the start of the Blitzkrieg into France, and I joined the 3rd Division signals in I think it was May 1940. The signals unit in a division consists of a headquarters group commanded by a colonel, and he acts as communications advisor to the divisional commander. So he is both a unit officer and a staff officer. And at the headquarters, there are certain basic units. There's all the communications for the divisional headquarters down to the battalions and artillery regiments and units that are under command, and then communications back to the Corps headquarters. There's also repair and maintenance unit that does relatively minor repairs to equipment, and then there's the stores group that handle distribution of equipment. But the remainder of the unit and the bulk of it is divided up into groups which are attached to the subordinate formations, brigades, armored brigades, field regiments, and any other troops that happen to be attached. So once the division is put on a wartime basis, the various sections of the signals are dispersed and attached to their units. And when we arrived in England after a year of training in Canada, within a very short time, I was, my section, which was called an artillery regiment section, was detached from the headquarters, and we moved in almost as part of the 14th Field Regiment.
Back in Canada, where were you stationed during that year of training?
After mobilizing in Calgary, and I mobilized, I recruited my own section, 27 men, I think it was. We concentrated in Kingston, Ontario, at a place called Barry Field Camp, which is still a military camp. It's Remy are in there now. And this was directly across the road from Vimy Barracks, which is the headquarters, the training headquarters for the signals in Canada, so that we had all the benefit of the permanent force signals people for training and equipment. And so we were there just as a signals unit. We had no fighting troops with us, and we concentrated on signals training, improving the efficiency of our signalers, the linemen, the dispatch riders, drivers, wireless operators, radio mechanics. And then we would do small exercises with no troops, just imaginary troops. Some of these exercises would be in the camp limits. Others would be out in the country. We got to know all the cheese factories and various places around Kingston.
After you had been mobilized, was the equipment starting to flood in?
It didn't flood in.
Oh, well, it was a larger trickle than
it yes. We started to get a lot of telephone equipment, new designs, and but we were still very short of wireless equipment. We were issued a small number of very old and obsolete radio transmitter receivers. I think it was called the number one set, which I believe had been developed at the end of the First World War, and it had remained the regular radio unit in the British Army. We used almost entirely British design equipment, although most of it was built in Canada. In fact, at that time, Canada started building great masses of equipment for the British, including guns and airplanes. And so there was always that frustration of not having the proper equipment. However, we battled along and managed to train our operators. Then the next move, it was part of a general plan to move troops towards the seaport, Halifax, in other words, in anticipation of a move overseas. And so after 6 months in Kingston, we were moved to DeBert Camp, which was a very large camp near Truro. I believe it's may still be in existence. This was a brutal move in below zero weather. We arrived in the camp in the dark, about 5 a.m, off the train and paraded into the camp. And as we walked in, we were walking through slushy ice because the waterworks had frozen up and the whole camp was under a sheet of ice. There was no water. It was, the camp had just, in fact, was still partly under construction when we moved in, but the capacity was for what was classed as a divisional group. It would be the normal troops in a division plus additional support troops, such as anti-aircraft batteries, anti-tank batteries, perhaps some armor units that might be under command of the division. So there were probably about 20,000 troops.
And they were still constructing the living quarters.
They were H huts. Yes, you've heard of H huts.
School.
That's right, you still have H huts at the U of H. So we were there, and we did get more equipment there, but we still didn't get the modern radio sets. But then we started doing field exercises with the units that we were destined to serve. And so I started working, that's when I started working with the 14th Field Regiment. It was an eastern unit with one battery from Shawinigan Falls, I think, another from Montreal, and the third one, I believe, was from Kingston. An interesting thing about the Montreal battery, the 44th battery, I believe, they were mainly, the officers were mainly stockbrokers and lawyers, and some of whom in later years went very far in their businesses. The colonel was a permanent force officer, Colonel Agnew. He was a very fine man. He was a very compassionate man, so much so that he had the nickname of Mother Agnew. He was a very nice man. I kept in touch with him for a few years after the war. So we started doing exercises, artillery shoots. There was an area in northern New Brunswick in the region of Tracadie, which is a very poor part of New Brunswick on the North Shore. And they had cleared, expropriated for the duration of the war, the few poor little farmers who lived in there. I don't know where they sent them, but anyway, they were probably better off than they had been scratching the rocky soil of New Brunswick. And there was a firing range established there, and we did actual barrages and moving chutes so that the signals had to take full part in the operation. And things went very wrong occasionally, and this was the only way to find out. We nearly killed the brigade major. Well, they started shooting before the 0 hour, and he was still driving across the range. He was going to an observation point on the other side of the range, and the barrage started while he was still out in the middle of it. He was very angry. But this was the sort of thing that happened, and then, of course, the signals in a in the barrage, the signals is extremely important, because all the various batteries, which may be, and even regiments, which may be several miles apart, have to receive their orders instantaneously. And if the plan is changed, it has to be, the information has to be sent down immediately. So it was very important, and regularly these radio sets would fail. However, we had telephone lines, which were used more than the radios at that stage. The this was an interesting too. We had an insulated wire that was laid on the ground, and it was carried generally in a small truck, small stake-bodied truck, on a reel, and it was paid out along the side of the road. So you could lay miles of telephone line in a very short time. But they were very vulnerable because traffic would break it. And of course, when we got into the real war, then the shelling would knock it out constantly. It was an endless job repairing telephone lines. But it was, at some stages, even during the later stages of the war, when there would be radio silence, telephones were used exclusively, plus dispatch riders on bicycles and motorcycles, and that was a hazardous job. But we did several shoots of Tracadie, I think, and then in the summer of 1941, in July, we were put on notice for overseas.
Were you happy with this?
Oh yes, everyone was delighted. Yeah, everyone
was. How had the conditions been at the camp?
They were good.
Were they?
Oh yeah, they were good.
Food was good.
The food, well, the army food, but as far as I was concerned, it was good.
Okay. And you crossed over in July.
In July, it was a very beautiful cruise across the Atlantic.
Good weather.
Beautiful weather. There were five troop ships. About half of 3rd Division went over in five troop ships. I was on board the HMS Orion. It was an Orient Line passenger vessel that normally plied between England and Australia. Beautiful ship. There were not many freighters. Again, there may not have been any freighters. It was a fast convoy, and we had about 10 corvettes and destroyers as escort. And right in the middle of the convoy was a battleship, the HMS. Oh, I've forgotten. It had been in a battle in the South Atlantic and had been very badly damaged and had been repaired at a shipyard in the United States, I think, Newport News. And this was interesting because the Americans were still neutral, but they bent the rules. They bent the rules quite a bit. I don't know how they accounted for this, but this ship had been repaired in an American yard. And it was on its way back to England, and we used to laugh about it because we said we were the protection for the battleship, and it looked like it because the five troop vessels formed an ellipse with the battleship right in the middle, so that the torpedo aimed at the battleship would probably hit one of the one of the troop ships. The conditions on the ship were reasonably good. Of course, I was an officer, so the conditions were considerably better than for the men, who many of whom slept in hammocks
far below deck,
far below the waterline. You always slept with your life jacket, and some people with a small bottle of rum. But it was a fast passage. I think we fast for for the convoy, I think it took us about 10 days.
And where did you land?
We landed at Avonmouth, near Bristol. It was an odd place to land, but I guess it was some of the major harbors were constantly under bombing attack, and I think they tried to disperse the landings as much as possible. The convoy broke up. I think some of the ships went to Greenock near Glasgow. Some may have gone to Liverpool, I'm not sure. But from there we went straight to Aldershot, which was the grimmest of grim places. There was no joy and no fun. The only fun was to go downtown to the pubs and the theaters.
What was wrong with Aldershot?
Well, the accommodation was old and unimaginative. There was no attempt at any kind of amenities. Well, there were canteens where you could drink beer and play darts, but the barrack rooms themselves were the grimmest of rooms. Each room held about 20 men who slept on little spring cots, which were telescopic, and in the daytime the downstream end would push in under the upstream end, and the blanket or the mattress was what was known as biscuits in the British Army. It was three squares about that size, but together formed a mattress, and they'd never stay together. If you moved around during the night, they'd separate and you'd end up between them. And during the day, the beds were telescoped, and the three biscuits were piled one on top of each other, and the blankets folded on top of that, and the pillow on top of that. The heating consisted of a tiny little coal fireplace. The firebox about that big, about 12 by 18. And the supply of coal was very, very short throughout all of England. And so people just froze. Here again, the officers were somewhat better off because we lived in rooms in the officers' mess. We had taken over one of the numerous barrack